With all the news about what happened with Hurricane Harvey, I thought I would talk about these natural disasters, as they're sometimes called, and occasionally they're called acts of God. Are they really acts of God? Where do such natural disasters come from? Is it global warming, as some scientists believe? The temperature of the ocean waters of the earth have risen 1.5 degrees in the last 10 years. In other words, are we doing this to ourselves? Or is there a supernatural cause? Are these acts of God or something else? Well, let's begin by going to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24. I think you would agree with me, we cannot deny that people think about God during times like these, certainly. I don't know how many of you have been watching the news and noticed that on Thursday, Governor Abbott of Texas made a declaration. I'd like to just read a couple of paragraphs from the declaration that he made. He says, "Whereas it is right and fitting that the people of Texas should join with their fellow residents and with others from across the country and around the world to seek God's wisdom for ourselves and our leaders and ask for his merciful intervention and healing at this time of crisis. Now, therefore, I, Greg Abbott, Governor of Texas, pursuant to the authority vested in me by the Constitution and statutes of the state of Texas, do hereby proclaim Sunday, September 3rd, 2017, as a day of prayer in Texas." As Christians, you cannot help but admire the humility expressed in such a proclamation. People do think of God during times like these. Oftentimes, people are thankful. At other times, they are angry with God and blame God for the disasters that do occur. I'd like to draw our attention to the words of Christ in Matthew 24, called the Olivet Prophecy, where Christ prophesied about events to come. His disciples had gathered around him in the first few verses of this chapter, and they were sitting on the Mount of Olives, and Christ gestured to the city below that had just recently been constructed by Herod. And they had a brand new gleaming temple mount with a new temple. And he told them earlier in this chapter, not one rock, not one stone would be left upon another here at some point in the near future. And then finally in verse 6, where I'd like to focus, verses 6 and 7, he said, "And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars." And of course, it was the war of the Romans bringing to bear on the Jews and their rebellion that caused the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Less than 40 years after Christ expressed these words. He says, "See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places." And here Christ includes natural, what we would call natural disasters that would occur. All of these things are the beginning of sorrows. And when you look at history, from the time Christ spoke these words until today, there have been some horrendous natural disasters, as we call them, that have occurred. Many of them from earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, tidal waves, the flood that occurred as a result of Hurricane Harvey was called a 1,000-year flood. In other words, it's the kind of flood that only happens every 1,000 years. And there's some mathematical reasoning to determine that, which goes well beyond my thinking. there have been a number of natural disasters. I know Linda and I were impressed when we visited some of the tells of historic cities in Asia Minor that are currently in Turkey. And we looked on a map one time we were driving, and it said, you know, if you turn to the right here, you go to a point of interest. You ever see those signs, point of interest? And we said, oh, there's a point of interest sign. Let's go over there. We drove over, and we looked on the map, and this was the city of Miletus. Remember that that's mentioned in the book of Acts? That Paul actually walked from ancient Smyrna down to Miletus, and his company that he was with decided to sail. So they sailed from Smyrna down to Miletus, but Paul wanted to walk. He wanted to think. And that's described in the book of Acts. And we thought, hey, this is neat. We can see the city of Miletus. I've never heard of this before. So we took this point of interest road, and we drove off, and we came to a big pile of rubble. And around it, of course, are weeds and goats walking around. And this is the ancient city of Miletus, completely vacated. And it makes you wonder, what happened? And as you walk through the ruins and the toppled columns and the big stones, and you find an amphitheater that's three quarters destroyed, but it's still visible. You can still tell what it was. And it makes you wonder. So we got out our history books as we were driving away from the site, and it said that the town of Miletus had been destroyed by an earthquake. And these stones and these columns are so big that the people, of course, didn't have heavy equipment like we have today, and they couldn't rebuild the city. So they just relocated the city. The survivors decided to build further up the coast, and they abandoned the city of Miletus, and it became just a pile of rubble. So that we could come along almost 2,000 years later and look at it and go, wow, they had some amazing architecture here. But they had such a bad earthquake there one time, it completely destroyed a city that Paul came to. He had a big meeting there with the elders from Ephesus that he called down that's recorded in the book of Acts. But that city no longer exists because it was completely destroyed by an earthquake. So Christ said, there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes. And I'm sure if they knew what a hurricane was in those days, he could have listed a hurricane. But of course, around Jerusalem, they probably had never experienced a hurricane at that point. So Christ said natural disasters would come. And of course, the question then becomes, okay, is it an act of God? Or where do they come from? Well, to get some kind of idea, let's go back to the book of Job. Job is a very interesting book. I think it's one of Linda's favorite books. She always asks me questions about Job, usually about 11:30 when I'm just about to doze off and we're in bed, you know, having kind of our end of the day discussion. And she goes, well, what about Job such and such and what was said there? And of course, I'm about to go into La La Land. And she always asks me these thought-provoking questions. And, of course, sometimes it keeps me awake at night. But I've always accused her of having Job as her favorite book in the Bible. You can ask her yourself after the service if you want. But in Job, we find verse 1, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And he was a righteous man, God says. Verse 8, the Lord said to Satan, because earlier it says that sometimes Satan appears before God. Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. And Satan said, well, no wonder you blessed him. You put a hedge about him. You've protected him. You've given him all kinds of blessings. He says, if you took away that hedge, if you took away some of those blessings, he would curse you. And so verse 12, the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on him. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Satan can only do what God gives him permission to do. He's limited in his power, and We see that from this interaction that occurs between a God and Satan here. What is really interesting, if you go down to verse 16, there are a number of instances in all addressing all of the resources that Job has. But I'd like to pick up just a couple here to illustrate the point. While he was still speaking, this one servant who came in to report that the Sabaeans had raided the flocks of Job and taken all of his animals away, and he said the while he was still speaking, another also came in and said in verse 16, the fire of God fell from heaven. Now, what would that be? Well, you and I might recognize it as lightning. Around here, particularly in the Sierras, what happens when lightning strikes? Well, oftentimes, it starts a forest fire, doesn't it? So you can imagine when fire, they call it the fire of God, of course it could be lightning, fell from heaven and then burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And I don't think it's any stretch of the imagination to imagine that this could have been lightning striking a forested area, perhaps where the servants and the sheep had taken refuge. And they fell prey to this fire. Verse 17 and 18 tell us there's another invasion, by this time the Chaldeans. And they killed servants. Drop down to verse 19. Another report. And suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house where his children were. And it fell on the young people and they were all dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And verse 20 says, then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and he fell to the ground, but he worshipped. Now, there's two instances in these several events that occur to Job that are clearly in the hand of Satan. Again, it's no stretch of our imagination to understand that Satan loves human suffering. He loves to see people suffer. Now, clearly, God allowed it to happen. As we see in many cases, God allows for a number of reasons. In this case, the end result was, frankly, a test on Job. So sometimes when natural disasters occur, I think we can safely conclude that there is a test of those who are victims or who may be involved, or maybe even for those of us who witness it from a distance. And of course, today, by modern technology, we can witness the disasters firsthand. You know, people have their cell phones out. They're taking videos. They're posting those almost immediately. They're taking pictures. You know, we get a firsthand view of these disasters. In the time of Job, of course, word of mouth had to spread about how these events occurred. I think clearly what we gain from this scripture is that Satan is often at the root cause of natural disasters. Only by the permission of God. Which brings up another question. Were these people who died in the floodwaters or the wind greater sinners? Or did God have it out for them in some way? There are many people who will claim that. And oftentimes do. In fact, let's go to the book of Luke, Luke 13. Luke 13. Beginning in verse 1, Luke 13, 1, we find that there were some among the scribes and the Pharisees who tried to make a direct connection in what we call the health and wealth doctrine. And that is, if you obey God and you do what God wants you to do, then you're going to get wealth and you're going to be healthy. And Christ was, there's a couple of instances. You may recall when they brought the young man who was blind from birth to him, and they asked They ask Christ, who sinned here, this young man or his parents? And, of course, Christ answered it in an unusual way because they have this health and wealth kind of belief and doctrine, which unfortunately is promulgated by some today, where they say, you know, if you're following God and you're obeying God, then you're gonna remain healthy and you're not going to be stricken with cancer or any other ailments, and God is going to continue to bless you financially. You know, kind of this non-regression theory. You know, you'll go through life and things will just get better and better and better and better. Well, I think Christ's own words tell us otherwise. Notice here in Luke 13, verse 1. Because, he said that of those, I kind of jumped away from that analogy or that reference I used earlier about the blind man. Christ said, neither one of these people sinned. You know, he made it clear that he didn't support this teaching of health and wealth. Verse 1 now of Luke 13, there were present at that season some who told him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. And Jesus answered and said, do you suppose that these Galileans were worse sinners than all other Galileans because they suffered these things? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you will also likewise perish. In verse 4, are those 18 on whom the tower of Siloam fell and killed them, do you think that they were worse sinners than all other men who dwell in Jerusalem? Christ was trying to knock into head this concept that just because you fall victim to a natural disaster, and clearly the falling of a tower, unless it was just shoddy workmanship, we assume that that may have been the result of an earthquake. Natural disaster, and this thing fell over. Were they worse? Were they worse sinners? Christ said in verse 5, I tell you no, but unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. Time and chance can happen to any of us. The thing is, God works with those who have His Spirit, whom He calls as His children. God's people have God's involvement in their lives, even if they fall prey to time and chance. Oftentimes to try the people, like in Job's case. Other times to test us who observe. How are we going to react to that? What are we going to say? Do we reflect the mind of God in such times, or do we react carnally? Let's go to 2 Timothy, chapter 3 and verse 1. 2 Timothy, chapter 3 and verse 1. Paul wrote this, 2 Timothy, chapter 3, verse 1. But know this, that in the last days, dangerous times will come. And truly, there are dangerous things that happen all around us. Everything from car accidents, which can occur to us and have to Christians, to natural disasters. Notice verse 2, he says, for men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy. You know, I was pleased to read the proclamation from Governor Abbott because he seemed to be thankful in spite of the disaster that struck the citizens of Houston in southeast Texas. Rather than blaming God, he said we should have a day of prayer, which I admire. But, of course, we also know there will be people who have the wrong motivation, who will come into Houston and begin to price gouge if they have resources for people who have needs. You know, in Beaumont, Texas, their water supply has been tainted and they can't drink the water. And 160,000 people in Beaumont had to line up for miles to get drinking water. Now, thankfully, that water was given out free, you know, by FEMA and by the National Guard. But you and I think, know human nature well enough. We know there's going to be people there who will sell other people water to drink. They will hike up their prices for gasoline. They will try to take advantage. As it says here, lovers of themselves and lovers of money, boasters. And in times of disaster, don't we kind of see both sides of the human spectrum? You know, God said of Adam and Eve, He says, if you partake of this tree, it is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. People can do good deeds. And I think we saw that, where people came from miles away, brought their boats, you know, were willing to wade in this tainted water with snakes and alligators and all kinds of pollution to rescue other people who were stranded in their homes. And you admire that. They're kind of the unsung heroes, volunteers who did such things. People who brought food. People who brought water. People who brought first aid. Volunteers, health care givers who volunteered their time. That's the good side. But there's the carnal side that's probably going to come out in the aftermath of this. People who are in the construction business in Texas. I know in our small community, constructors, general contractors, take advantage of old people. And we get warnings all the time in our community. A lot of those condos were built in the mid-60s and 70s, and they do upgrades. And when they charge $250 a square foot for a remodel on a condominium, when the average price to construct a house from the ground up is $211 a square foot, you know that somebody is making some big money somewhere. And they're taking advantage of elderly people who either don't have the savvy or the will to get multiple bids and kind of shop around and to get, you know, people just are that way. It doesn't stretch my imagination to think that in Houston, constructors are going to come along, contractors, and they're going to say, well, I'm very busy now, but I'll do your job for twice the going rate. You know, instead of paying me $300 to $400 a day for my services, I'll do it for $600 or $700. I mean, we all know human nature, don't we? He continues with the list: proud, blasphemer, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. They're having a form of godliness. They're like our nation. We pretend to be a Christian nation, but denying its power. Notice the next sentence. And from such people, turn away. From such people, turn away. With the advent of social media, it is sometimes easy to be influenced. Have you noticed that? Influenced by the attitude of the people who post or the people who express opinions. And sometimes they go, yeah, I feel that same way. Retweet, you know, repost. Yeah, that's the way I feel right now. And sometimes people regret that. After they've had a night to sleep on it, they go, oh, that didn't really sound too good, does it? It sounds like a carnal reaction. Like the people whose lives were saved, but they were very, very critical of the government for not telling them to move out of their houses. They're very critical of the government not to be there. You know, FEMA's got over 100,000 properties now to approve financial aid for. But a couple of people I saw interviewed on CNN were very angry with the government and upset, primarily because they had a sense of entitlement. You know, Uncle Sam should have saved me from myself and my own stupidity, you know, for staying in the house. Like Linda was saying, she kept saying, why didn't the people get out? You know, They had like 4 or 5 days warning. Of course, everybody thinks, it's not as bad as the government tells me. Then when it happens, why didn't the government tell me? On and on it goes. From such, people turn away. Maybe God is testing. Are people really? Are people really reacting in a godly way? I find that very interesting. From such, turn away. Some do good, some curse God. Others exercise self-discipline. Others are without restraint. What do we do if there are no physical constraints? What do you think would happen in Houston if there was no law? What would happen if the National Guard wasn't there? Well, we know what would happen, and we know what probably is going to happen and what is happening. Looting takes place. People go into those homes that have been abandoned and steal things. Carnal nature comes out. It's kind of interesting. I'd like to share with you a couple of quotes. This is from Edmund Burke in a book entitled Reflections from the Revolution, talking about the French Revolution. The American Revolution was fashioned, I guess all of us know that, after the French Revolution. But Edmund Burke, in reading about the French Revolution, wrote this: to make a government requires no great prudence. Settle the seat of power, teach obedience, and the work is done. To give freedom is still more easy. It is not necessary to guide. It requires only to let go the reins. But to form a free government, that is to temper together the opposite elements of liberty and restraint in one consistent work, requires much thought, deep reflection, and a sagacious, powerful, and combining mind. This was when Americans were thinking about forming a free government. How do you do that? How do you combine freedom with restraint? How does that happen in people's minds? Well, I think all of us know that it doesn't happen. And it won't happen without the intervention of Jesus Christ becoming King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And, of course, we're going to be celebrating that in the next 4 holy days that we observe. Let's go to Jeremiah 6 and read what the prophet had to say. Jeremiah 6 and verse 7. Jeremiah 6, 7, the prophet wrote, as a fountain wells up with water, so she wells up with wickedness. Talking about ancient Israel. And the human nature, sadly, has not changed. Violence and plundering are heard in her. Before me continually are grief and wounds. Be instructed, O Jerusalem, lest my soul depart from you, lest I make you desolate, a land not inhabited. Be instructed. I think God calls upon us in the face of disaster, whether we're just a lurker viewing it or whether we're affected by it, there's some instruction that we can learn from these disasters. That's what the prophet is saying. We need to learn some lessons. And I think you and I can learn. We can be instructed. What is it we can learn from such disasters? Because, all of us know very well that we live on fault lines here. They're predicting that the next major earthquake is way overdue. We could be victims of a major disaster quite easily. How would we react to that? What would we do? Is there something we can learn about what we might do at a time like that? Do we have an attitude of entitlement? Would we be tempted to blame the governor, the local police force, the National Guard, the guy that built our house so it couldn't withstand such a disaster? How would we react? Today we're sobered, we're sympathetic. But how will we feel tomorrow when the images of those sufferings diminish? go back to Jeremiah 18, verse 11. Jeremiah 18, 11. Can we learn something from this? Like I said, most of us are not directly affected, although Linda and I know some people who were flooded in their homes down there. One family was a part of our congregation in Los Angeles, and when they started having children, they didn't want to raise them in L.A., so they moved to Houston and bought several acres of property outside of town and went to set up a farm, and they got animals for the kids. And during this storm, their house, they had to be evacuated by their neighbors who had big four-wheel drives to drive them out. And when they came back in, there was about 3 feet of water in their house. All their furniture destroyed, the floors in their home, the walls up to about 4 feet. And that's when friends and church members and even neighbors came over to their house and helped them pull up the floorboards, helped them cut the drywall so the water couldn't saturate or wick up any further. And now they have to let all the joists and all the wood kind of dry out and make sure there's no mold, and then they have to rebuild. You know, put up new drywall, new insulation, new floors. We know people that have experienced this, but most of us probably don't know personally people who have been victims of this. Jeremiah 18 and verse 11. Jeremiah 18, verse 11. Now therefore speak to the men of Judah and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and say, thus says the Lord, behold, I am fashioning a disaster, devising a plan against you, Reuben. Now every one for his evil way, and make your ways and your doings good. And they said, well, that's hopeless. So we will walk according to our own plans, and we will every one obey the dictates of his evil heart. Will we just keep going on in life as we were, or is there a lesson here? That's what the prophet asked the ancient Jews. Is there a lesson here for us? And I think there is. I'd like to share with you another quote from that book that I read earlier about reflections. This is Edmund Burke wrote this in response to a member of the French Parliament. He said, men are qualified for civil liberty in exact proportion to their disposition to put moral chains on their own appetites, in proportion as their love of justice is above their rapacity, in proportion as their soundness of sobriety of understanding is above their vanity and presumption, in proportion as they are more disposed to listen to the counsel wise and good in preference to the flattery of knaves. Society cannot exist unless a controlling appetite is placed somewhere. And the less there is within, the more there must be without. It is ordained in the eternal constitution of things that men of intemperate minds can never be free. Where is our mind? I think those words are true. And that's the challenge that even America and, of course, before her, France, has tried to negotiate, is how do you have a free society when the moral appetites on the individual are not constrained or controlled? Let's go to Psalms 55. Psalms 55, verse 4. We have a lot of sympathy, I think, for people who have been victims of this horrible disaster. We know that it's not God-authored. God allowed it to happen. But again, we ask the question, why did God allow it to happen? Well, I believe, like Job, some people's character is being tried. But for us, who look at it from a distance, I think we can understand these words. I think of my friend and the family that we know down there that was directly affected by this storm. In verse 4, like David wrote, my heart is severely pained within me, and the terrors of death have fallen upon me. They thought they were going to drown in that house as the water began to rise, and their car wouldn't even start, so much water in the driveway. How do we get out of here? As far as the eye could see, there was nothing but water. And the neighbor showed up, you know, with his Bigfoot truck and was able to get them out. Fearfulness and trembling have come upon me, and horror has overwhelmed me. So I said, oh, that I had wings like a dove. I would fly away and be at rest. Indeed, I would wander far off and remain in the wilderness. When Linda and I lived near Lake Arrowhead, and the fires came across those mountains, and we were evacuated for 2 weeks. And we didn't know from day to day whether or not our home had been destroyed in the fire. This is kind of the way we felt. We felt victimized by the disaster, a natural disaster. Verse 8, I would hasten my escape from the windy storm and the tempest. You have a little different perspective when you're going through the trial. But I think there are lessons here for all of us, not just those who are going through it like our friends in Houston, the probably 300,000 people that have been displaced or affected by this storm, like Job. It's a personal trial for them. They need our understanding and our sympathy, not just to turn off the news. And like the old saying goes, 80% of the people who see such things are glad it's not them, and the other 20% don't really care. Hopefully we can be like the 0.5% who care and who mourn for their loss, who understand, as David wrote in this psalm, the agony they're experiencing, and to pray for them, to be concerned. Our heart goes out to them. I'd like to end over in Ezekiel with another prophet, Ezekiel. Chapter 7, verse 26. Ezekiel 7, verse 26. The prophet wrote, disaster will come upon disaster. You know, this is not the last hurricane that will strike the American coast. While we're being distracted by Hurricane Harvey, you know what's happening to the people in Bangladesh? One of the worst cyclones, a 500-year cyclone, is hitting them. A nation of 170 million people is 60% underwater right now. 60%. 1,200 people have drowned that they know about so far. Again, most of us are probably not even aware because, you know, we're distracted by what's happening in our backyard. Disaster will come upon disaster, the prophet wrote, and rumor will be upon rumor. Then they will seek a vision from a prophet. You know, why is this happening? But the law will perish from the priest and counsel from the elders. I'm sure that the disaster in Houston will turn into a political finger-pointing mess, just like Sandy did in our country. Because human nature will come out again. People's personal interests will dominate. Verse 27, the king will mourn, the prince will be clothed with desolation, and the hands of the common people will tremble. I will do to them according to their way and according to what they deserve. I will judge them. Then they will know that I am the Lord. Oftentimes when people go through such experiences, they turn to God and say, teach me. It's a humbling moment. It's a teachable moment is created. But of course, there are other times when people turn to God and shake their finger in His face and say, why did you bring this on me? And they curse God. Which, of course, Job's friends encouraged him to do. His wife did. She said, why don't you just curse God and get it over with? Over to Ezekiel 9, verse 6, just right across the page in my Bible. Ezekiel 9, verse 6. The Lord said to this angel, go through the midst of the city through the midst of Jerusalem and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it. You know, I thought about this the last couple of days. Maybe God is looking to see what our reaction is going to be. Now, I know that our hearts go out to these people in our prayers. And sometimes if we have a little bit of resource, we want to help somebody. In fact, I had a member call me this week and say that there was a truck driver in their local Safeway parking lot who was collecting canned goods and was going to drive them down to Houston. And I said, well, what's the name of his organization? She gave me the name and I looked it up online and I said, you know, this organization does not have a very good reputation. She said, what? I said, you need to make sure if you're going to help physically, and we may be able to, we may want to, and we may have resources that we can help and make a contribution. Don't be stupid. You know, there are people out there who will gladly take your money, who are not legitimate, and they often prey at times like this on people who do have a heart that sighs and cries for the suffering that people go through. But I think God is looking at us. He's saying, okay, what will my children do? What will my servants do? In verse 5, he says, to the others he said in my hearing, go after him through the city and kill. Do not let your eyes spare, nor have any pity. Utterly slay old and young, men, maidens, little children, and women. But do not come near anyone on whom is the mark. God is watching. He's observing. He oftentimes allows these circumstances that Satan causes to happen, human suffering, to measure the Christianity of the rest of us. What will we do? It's interesting, he says, and begin at my sanctuary. Start measuring and seeing who is sighing and crying. Start at my sanctuary. And so they began with the elders who were before the temple. God is watching. He's watching us. He's wanting to test our response. How will we react at such a time? Will we pray for these people? Will we be concerned for them? Will we moan and groan and seek God so that we strengthen our faith during times like this rather than doubt our faith? I think the question is clear. Do we sigh and cry for the misery that we see when it does occur? If we experience a natural disaster or a personal trial or a great loss, what is our response? How do we react? Oftentimes I tell people who go through such things, this is a test. Like on the TV, remember that old pattern? This is a test. And oftentimes, natural disasters and personal trials are a test. Not just for the people involved, but for the rest of us who watch. Isn't that what God is looking for? Isn't he looking to see how we will react and what response we will have? Will we truly sigh and cry for the disasters that we see?